Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. This weekend marked the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights March in Selma, Alabama, that became known as Bloody Sunday. Today, we'll tell you the shocking findings of investigative reporter Greg Pallast, who has uncovered new schemes to disenfranchise African-American voters across America a half century after passage of the historic Voting Rights Act. On the second half of our show today, we'll be playing President Barack Obama's speech delivered on that bridge in Selma, Alabama, Sunday, and also I'll be sharing some memories of how the courage of those marchers once impacted me as a young legislative aide working on a bill to make Reverend Martin Luther King's birthday a state holiday, even while the Ku Klux Klan was marching on the Capitol lawn. But first, we have some local and national news to report. We'll have details about threats that prompted several school lockdowns around the San Diego region, as well as the arrest of two individuals tied to school safety threats right here in East County. The County of San Diego wants to take over an unfinished firefighting training center from the San Miguel Fire Department. We'll have details on why on today's show. On our local government report, we'll tell you about some important agenda items coming up on boards and councils across East County this week. Plus, we'll have details about a proposal to finally repair and reopen the East County Performing Arts Center, and why one local activist is threatening a possible lawsuit over constitutional issues. In sports, we'll tell you about a San Diego State team that's just captured its sixth Mountain West title. We'll also have information today on the first medical marijuana dispensary set to open legally in the city of San Diego. And then on Crime Beat, hear how some armed robbers preying on local shoppers got caught. Local Chaldeans and Assyrians who are hoping to see persecuted Christians from the Middle East brought to safe haven in America have just received support from a powerful force, and we'll have details. We'll also have news about a fatal hit and run in Lemon Grove, a dramatic rescue of an injured horse and rider in a local canyon preserve, and a warning about identity thieves preying on taxpayers in California. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, because East County matters.
A 14-year-old Monte Vista High School student has been arrested after a gun was found in its locker on Friday, the sheriff reports. After students told officials that a fellow student had a gun, the campus in Spring Valley was placed in lockdown. A search revealed a Western-style gun and drugs in the teen's locker. Three other schools were locked down in San Diego Friday morning after an anonymous email threat was sent to district officials. The lockdowns were imposed at Lewis Middle School in Allied Gardens, Thurgood Marshall Middle School in Scripps Ranch, and Magnolia Science Academy in San Carlos. Times of San Diego reports that at a fourth campus, Lincoln Park, students sheltered in place. Friday's school security crackdowns come on the heel of an arrest just one day earlier of a woman who threatened to shoot up a lakeside school, prompting lockdown or tightened security measures at several lakeside campuses. For East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
As the nation commemorates the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights March in Selma, investigative reporter Greg Pallast has published findings that show we still have a long way to go as a nation to achieve civil rights for all people and voting rights for all people. A special investigation conducted by Pallast found a massive secret database used by election officials in 28 states. Nearly all of those officials were Republicans, and the scheme, called Interstate Crosscheck, threatened to disqualify ballots of over 1 million voters, and overwhelmingly, these were citizens of color. With help from Al Jazeera America, Pallast obtained the actual names of over 2 million of those 3.5 million citizens being threatened with disenfranchisement. Republican election officials claimed these people had voted twice in the same election in two different states. If true, that would be a crime. The officials said those mail-in ballots would be thrown away and that voters' registrations would be voided. Pallast found the officials were disqualifying people who had similar names to people in other states, For instance, an election official claimed that Kevin Antonio Hayes in North Carolina and Kevin Thomas Hayes in Virginia were the same person, despite a lack of any evidence whatsoever that Kevin Hayes in North Carolina had voted twice. The only similarity between the two voters was their first and last names, but not their middle names. This was a pattern he found over and over. North Carolina managed to disqualify enough voters of color using this technique to flip a U.S. Senate race into the red column last November, says Palast, who also questioned why none of these voters were arrested if authorities really believed they had voted twice. Martin Luther King III has asked why the preponderance of black voters in the South has not turned more states blue. Despite high African-American populations, states like Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and the Carolinas still have solid Republican leadership. Decades ago, bigots in the South relied on Jim Crow laws, lynchings, and beatings to help keep African-American voters from the polls. But today, Palast observes, Jim Crow has traded in his white sheets for spreadsheets. Those electronic databases are reversing the gains made by the Voting Rights Act, celebrated in the closing scenes of the movie Selma. It's not only disenfranchisement of individual voters that's a problem. One notorious election in 2002 saw an Alabama courthouse lock its doors to recount the votes, barring the press and black Democrats. In the morning, white officials claimed they had found a glitch in the count that reversed the outcome of the election, shifting over 6,000 votes away from a Democratic candidate favored by black voters. There were no paper ballots, and there was no way to verify this seemingly suspicious outcome. Those are just two of nine methods that Palast claims to have uncovered, being used today to disenfranchise an estimated 5.9 million black voters in modern-day America. Moreover, in June 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court nullified key provisions of the Voting Rights Act, and Republican-controlled Congress has thus far been unwilling to take actions to restore those lost rights. The High Court threw out a provision which had required states with a pattern of racial discrimination in the past to get congressional approval before changing voting laws for the future. Palast concludes that the march in Selma is not over, and that America collectively needs to march over the bridge again and again and again. Palast, whose parents formerly lived right here in La Mesa in East County, has won international recognition for his reporting on voter discrimination and disenfranchisement. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery. Out of money to complete construction and maintenance of a partially built training facility in Casa de Oro, the San Miguel Fire District on March 11th will consider a proposal from the County Fire Authority to take over the lease, move forward on construction, and assume maintenance responsibilities. The training facility was deemed a high priority back in 2007 for San Miguel Fire, which signed a 30-year lease with Otay Water District for the 3.5-acre site that would be operated jointly with Heartland Fire Training Authority. From 2007 to 2009, San Miguel received over $2 million from an Indian gaming grant to build Phase 1, which was completed in June of 2012. But there was one big problem. The site included only concrete, fire hydrants, props, and a bridge overpass for training, but no water meter, so the training facility is still not operational. According to a staff report sent to the San Miguel Board and authored by Tony Meacham, Cal Fire and County Fire Chief, the district and Heartland Fire Training Authority both lack the funds to develop the rest of the project for completion. The cost of opening the facility exceeds $1.5 million, not counting maintenance costs. Costs for minimal improvements required to use the training site total about $1 million for a water meter, water recovery system, and road improvements. Since the County Fire Authority also needs a training center, the county is now proposing to fund, develop, and operate the training center for the rest of the lease. The county would invest $1.4 million in the next fiscal year to make the facility operational. After that, the County Fire Authority would spend another $500,000 for development of training props and facilities. The county will control the lease, and county fire training staff will maintain the center. The staff report recommends that San Miguel Fire District's board approve entering into negotiations to hand over control of the training facility. The district's taxpayers would incur no further costs, and the long-term estimated savings for the district would be in the millions of dollars for the county to develop and operate the training center. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
And now for a sports report from East County Magazine. The Aztecs men's basketball team has captured its 9th Mountain West title, the highest number in league history. The Aztecs defeated Nevada State 67-43 at Viejas Arena on Saturday night to secure their title, which is shared with Boise State. The Aztecs had 3 players score in double digits, Dwayne Poley III, Aquin Quinn, and Winston Shepard. 6 others scored 7 points or more. Boise landed the #1 seed in the conference tournament set to start late this week in Las Vegas. The Aztecs are #2 seed and will play in the quarterfinals on Thursday night at 6 p.m. Semifinals will be on Friday night with final rounds on Saturday. Aztecs athletics are hot overall. Since the beginning of 2012 to 2013, San Diego State University has won a total of 23 team conference championships. This season alone, SDSU has won 4 Mountain West titles, women's soccer regular season, women's soccer tournament, women's swimming and diving, and now men's basketball.
The East County Performing Arts Center, or ECPAC, has been closed for 5 years in need of roofing repairs and other renovations, but the City Council appears to finally be poised to move forward on repairs. On March 10th, the El Cajon City Council's consent calendar includes approval of plans and bid specifications for improvements to the theater. The estimated cost of the renovations is just under $3 million, significantly less than the original $4.7 million estimate projected back in 2010. The council will invite sealed bids that would be opened on May 7th. Ray Lutz, founder of Save ECPAC, called news that the city is ready to finally approve renovations fantastic. But he voiced concerns over the constitutionality of a partnership with the Rock Church that the city has been weighing. Lutz opposes a long-term lease between the city and Rock Church that would tie up the theater from use by other groups every Sunday and on many other dates during the year, although he adds that the church has the right to rent the facility on equal terms and conditions as any other user. Since a recent meeting on pricing negotiations with Rock Church was in closed session, it is unclear whether the renovation funding hinges on approval of a deal with Rock Church or not. For now, says Lutz, we should be overjoyed that the city is finally going to sink some money into the theater to fix it up for reopening. But he adds in an email sent to members of the watchdog group Citizens Oversight, if they try to ink a long-term lease deal with the Rock Church, then we will file a lawsuit to prevent the takeover. The city contends that any deal with Rock Church will be constitutional. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
The very first permit allowing for the operation of a medical marijuana dispensary in San Diego was approved by the San Diego City Council. The Green Alternative on Roll Drive near Brownfield and Otay Mesa has the green light to open its doors soon. Technically speaking, the Outlier Collective, permitted by the County of San Diego, was the first dispensary to open in the entire county over at Gillespie Field in El Cajon. Zoning restrictions require the dispensary be away from neighborhoods, schools, daycare, or public parks. Channel 10 reports that City Commissioner Susan Pearson said the Green Alternative meets and exceeds the requirements of the permit. Blair and his representatives told the commissioner that they have hired a security firm to provide guards at all times for the facility. They also said the nearest neighborhood is 4.9 miles away, and the nearest residence, which is just under 2 miles away, is a prison, literally the Otay Mesa prison. Blair said, the reason that we floated to the first position among permit applicants is because every time the city required something of us, we doubled it. But not everyone is convinced so easily. Carla Bernal works at an insurance agency near the soon-to-be location of a Green Alternative and said the business complex is no place for marijuana sales. Fox 5 reports that, among other things, the city council wants the annual permit fee to equal the cost of inspections and other expenses needed to regulate the dispensaries. The city's projected costs include the use of police officers to make background checks, fire personnel, zoning investigators, planners, and city treasury employees. Prospective owners of the medical marijuana facilities are currently going through a costly and time-consuming process to acquire a conditional use permit, which will allow them to open. Other operating conditions require background checks of prospective permit holders and employees and testing of marijuana for the presence of pesticides, bacteria, mold, or mildew. Councilwoman Lori Zapp casts the dissenting vote, calling the law vague. Once the legal dispensaries open, they'll be limited to 4 per city council district for a total of 36 within the San Diego city limits. Numerous shops operating illegally have been shut down over the past year. This has been Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
This is Miriam Raftery with this week's local government report. The CREST, Tehesa, Granite Hills, and Harbison Canyon Planning Group is meeting Monday, March 9th at 7 p.m. The community of CREST currently has only one way in and one way out, which is a serious danger during a major wildfire. This week, the planning group will consider a proposal to create an emergency egress route from CREST through an avocado grove north to Interstate 8. The La Mesa City Council meets Tuesday, March 10th at 4 p.m. The council will consider a staff recommendation to negotiate with Westmont Companies to develop a senior living facility next to Briarcrest Park. Council will also hold a hearing on establishing in-lieu parking fees of $25,000 a parking space for non-residential construction downtown. El Cajon's City Council holds its meetings on Tuesday, March 10th at 3 p.m. The council has several items of interest on its consent calendar this week, including a recommendation to approve $634,000 in Cal Grant funds for loans to help low-income first-time homebuyers, a proposal to apply for a playground grant from Kaboom, and a staff recommendation to accept bids to upgrade the East County Performing Arts Center. The Lakeside Fire District Board meets March 10th at 5:30 p.m. The agenda includes a discussion of relocating Fire Station Number 1, installing solar at the River Park facility, and a closed-session discussion on employee contract negotiations. Grossmont Union High School District's Board also meets March 10th, with a public session starting at 6 p.m. The agenda includes a vote on whether to renew the charter for Helix Charter High School. Also, a motion to hire an auctioneer to dispose of surplus district property, a proposal to partner with the county to help reduce child abuse, and a motion to purchase web-based labor compliance software. The Santee City Council meets Wednesday, March 11th at 7 p.m. Council will consider authorizing the city manager to send a letter to El Cajon in support of a smart growth incentive planning grant, which Santee would support with $15,000 in matching funds if the grant is approved. The San Miguel Fire Board meets March 11th at 5:30. This week, the board will consider purchase of new fire apparatus, as well as a proposal by the County Fire Authority to take over the district's fire training center.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
This is Leon Thompson with a Crime Beat report on East County Magazine. Two suspects are under arrest on suspicion of two armed robberies that occurred Friday at a Vaughn store in La Mesa and at Fashion Valley Shopping Mall in San Diego. The crimes were solved thanks to the alert observations of the victims. At 11 p.m. Friday night, a man armed with a handgun stole a purse from a woman in the parking lot at the Vaughn store on Lake Murray Boulevard in La Mesa. He fled in a white SUV driven by a woman. The victim called La Mesa police with a description of the two suspects and a license plate of the getaway vehicle. Earlier in the evening at around 8:25 p.m., San Diego police responded to a similar robbery at Fashion Valley. In that case, the victims were also able to obtain the license plate on the suspect vehicle, and the information was broadcast to surrounding law enforcement agencies. La Mesa police searched the area near the La Mesa robbery with help from the San Diego Police Able helicopter. A La Mesa police officer found the vehicle traveling westbound on I-8 near the I-15 interchange. With assistance from ABLE and the San Diego Sheriff's Department canine unit, officers from the La Mesa and San Diego Police Department stopped the vehicle at Friars Road and Frazee Road. Two suspects were taken into custody, 22-year-old Brian Coates and 23-year-old Renisha Bransford, both of San Diego. Investigators recovered a revolver used during the robbery and property stolen from the victims in both cases. The suspects were booked for robbery and conspiracy.
Last week, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops issued a press release urging the global community, led by the United States and Europe, to take action to save the lives of 4 million Syrian refugees. Anastasia Brown, the interim executive director for Migration and Refugee Services with the Bishops Group, says, "Without more international support, we will find Syrians fleeing extremists being turned away and forced back to danger." A delegation of officials from the Bishops Conference visited the region in late 2014 and released the report on March 6th. The delegation expressed grave concern for the plight of religious minorities, who are targets of extremists in the region, as recent captures and beheadings have shown. Assyrian and Chaldean Christians, along with Yazidis, are at risk of their lives. Brown says, without a dramatic response to this unprecedented humanitarian challenge, we will continue to see ongoing suffering and even death in this population, especially among the most vulnerable. The report is titled, Refuge and Hope in the Time of ISIS, the Urgent Need for Protection, Humanitarian Support, and Durable Solutions in Turkey, Bulgaria, and Greece. It highlights the struggles that Syrian refugees face as they attempt to find protection, with many traveling through Greece and Bulgaria on their way to Europe. According to the United Nations, many more are taking dangerous sea journeys in boats to reach the continent. Meanwhile, Syria and Iraq are tightening border policies, restricting the flow of Syrian refugees. Refugee Policy Advisor Matt Wilch states, it was apparent from our trip that the protection space in the region for Syrians is shrinking. People are becoming more desperate, and they're attempting dangerous journeys to Europe and beyond. Of special note is the impact the crisis is having on children, who number as many as 2 million, half the total of Syrian refugees. Among those are unaccompanied children who, according to the delegation, have a special claim on protection. Nathalie Lumert, Director of Special Programs, says the number of unaccompanied children and other vulnerable children from Syria and elsewhere is rising, yet there are few protection mechanisms in place to identify and rescue them from harm. What we are seeing is an exodus of the next generation in Syria with little hope for their future. The delegation's report lists several recommendations to address the crisis, including increased refugee assistance and resettlement in other countries. Mark Arabo, a national spokesman for the Iraqi Chaldean Christian community here in East County, which has an estimated 50,000 to 60,000 Iraqi American Chaldeans, issued this statement in response. The shift in thinking on the part of church leadership indicates that the option for resettlement continues to grow more and more appealing, Arabo says. We applaud the willingness of the USCCB to recognize the atrocities occurring against the displaced Christians of Iraq and Syria and the realization that many of these individuals will never be able to return home. We must grant those who wish to leave their respective nations the chance to worship freely in a nation of tolerance and acceptance. That nation is the United States. Arabo, who has been meeting with White House officials and the State Department in recent days, adds, this is the momentum we need to carry our mission forward in ending the Holocaust of Christians in Iraq and Syria. We continue to work with church leadership and officials in D.C. to ensure that all options are on the table when confronting the genocide of Christians at the hands of ISIS. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
A 22-year-old woman was struck by an SUV and killed Saturday night in Lemon Grove. According to CBS News, the woman was jogging on Massachusetts, the street where she lived, when she was hit by the SUV. The driver fled the scene, but returned an hour and a half later and turned himself in to law enforcement. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
Too many California taxpayers are putting themselves at risk of tax identity theft. Nancy McPherson with AARP California says not safeguarding your personal information makes it easy for scammers to electronically file your tax return and collect your tax refund. She says all they need is a birth date and social security number, and many taxpayers make their personal information easy pickings.
Many people fail to lock their mailbox, a really simple thing that they can do. They leave valuables exposed in their cars, and they fail to destroy personal information.
She says filing your tax return early is another way to beat con artists to the punch. A recent study by the Federal Trade Commission ranks California third in ID theft complaints. McPherson says AARP's Fraud Watch Network also encourages people to not give out personal information unless they know who's asking for it and why they need it. Also, shred personal and financial documents such as pay stubs and make sure your tax preparer is legitimate.
And I think that's where AARP really can provide help with our tax aid program that helps millions of low to moderate income taxpayers, especially people who are 60 and older, file their tax returns and get the credits and deductions they deserve.
AARP's tax aid program is the nation's largest free volunteer-run tax preparation program. Find out more about the program at aarp.org/taxaid or 1-888-227-7669. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
Humane Society officers, City Park Rangers, and San Diego Police teamed up for a dramatic rescue Thursday in Black Mountain Open Space Park in Rancho Peñasquitos. A woman called 911 to report that she'd been thrown off her horse and that her startled horse had then fallen into a ravine. UT San Diego reports the rider was rescued and suffered only minor scrapes to her legs. Search crews found the horse 20 feet down a steep slope. Although the horse had an injured leg, it was able to walk out a trail cut through the brush by park rangers, who also rescued the rider's dogs. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery, host of the East County Magazine Show. Sunday marked the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, when marchers in Selma, Alabama were attacked and beaten back by police as they marched for voting rights back in 1965. The incident sparked national outrage and ultimately helped win passage of the Voting Rights Act. As we reported earlier on today's show, voting rights are once again under assault across the United States as bigotry and attempts to suppress African American votes continue long after that fateful day in Selma. This story hits home for me, a white American in California who, like many, once believed that racism was largely confined to the South, an ugly relic of the past. But back in 1980, on my first day on the job working as a legislative aide to State Senator Elihu Harris in the state capitol, I was asked to write a floor speech for his bill that would make Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a state holiday in California. I was surprised that as the token honky on an otherwise all-black staff, I was given the honor of this important responsibility. So while the rest of the staff went out to lunch, I stayed in the office to write the speech. There was major opposition to the bill, including the Ku Klux Klan, which was protesting on the Capitol lawn even as I was writing about the impassioned words of Dr. King on behalf of civil rights and voting rights. The state police stopped by to warn me that a bomb threat had been received, and I knew that of all the offices in the Capitol, ours was the most likely target on that day. We also received phone calls from bigots spouting hate speech and even threats. For a brief moment, I considered evacuating to protect my safety, but then I thought of those marchers in Selma and in civil rights marches all across the South, braving everything to win civil rights and voting rights for all Americans. And I knew that I could not leave. Seeing such hatred based solely on racism only motivated me to stay in and try even harder to write an impassioned speech, one that proved successful in helping secure the bill's passage, in which we all took great pride, scoring one small victory over hatred and racism. California's bill, of course, later helped to inspire passage of a national Martin Luther King birthday bill that was signed into law in 1983 by President Ronald Reagan. But back in 1965, when the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and courageous advocates of voting rights from across the nation converged for that march across the bridge in Selma, Alabama, the event swiftly turned violent, proving that America had a long way to go back then to assure equal rights for African Americans. We still have a long way to go yet today, as President Barack Obama made clear in a speech delivered to a crowd on that bridge in Selma, Alabama this Sunday. Today, we devote our second half hour of our show to play the President's speech in its entirety, celebrating the victories achieved since Selma, as well as urging that the march symbolically carry on, calling for social justice and voting rights for all Americans.
It is a rare honor in this life to follow one of your heroes. and John Lewis is one of my heroes. Now, I have to imagine that when a younger John Lewis woke up that morning, 50 years ago, and made his way to Brown Chapel, heroics were not on his mind. A day like this was not on his mind. Young folks with bedrolls and backpacks were milling about. Veterans of the movement trained newcomers in the tactics of nonviolence, the right way to protect yourself when attacked. A doctor described what tear gas does to the body, while marchers scribbled down instructions for contacting their loved ones. The air was thick with doubt, anticipation, and fear. And they comforted themselves with the final verse of the final hymn they sung. No matter what may be the test, God will take care of you. Lean, weary one, upon his breast, God will take care of you. And then his knapsack stocked with an apple, a toothbrush, and a book on government, all you need for a night behind bars, John Lewis led them out of the church on a mission to change America. President and Mrs. Bush, Governor Bentley, Mayor Evans, Congresswoman Sewell, Reverend Strong, members of Congress, elected officials, foot soldiers, friends, fellow Americans. As John noted, there are places and moments in America where this nation's destiny has been decided. Many are sites of war: Concord and Lexington, Appomattox, Gettysburg. Others are sites that symbolize the daring of America's character: Independence Hall and Seneca Falls, Kitty Hawk and Cape Canaveral. Selma is such a place. In one afternoon 50 years ago, so much of our turbulent history, the stain of slavery and anguish of civil war, the yoke of segregation and tyranny of Jim Crow, the death of four little girls in Birmingham, and the dream of a Baptist preacher, all that history met on this bridge. It was not a clash of armies, but a clash of wills, a contest to determine the true meaning of America. And because of men and women like John Lewis, Joseph Lowery, Hosea Williams, Amelia Bunting, Diane Nash, Ralph Abernathy, C.T. Vivian, Andrew Young, Fred Shuttlesworth, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., so many others, the idea of a just America, an a fair America, an inclusive America, and a generous America, that idea ultimately triumphed. Now, as is true across the landscape of American history, we cannot examine this moment in isolation. The March on Selma was part of a broader campaign that spanned generations. The leaders that day part of a long line of heroes. We gather here to celebrate them. We gather here to honor the courage of ordinary Americans willing to endure billy clubs and the chastening rod, tear gas and the trampling hoof, men and women who, despite the gush of blood and splintered bone, would stay true to their North Star and keep marching towards justice. They did as Scripture instructed: rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer. And in the days to come, they went back again and again. When the trumpet call sounded for more to join, the people came. Black and white, young and old, Christian and Jew, waving the American flag, singing the same anthems full of faith and hope. A white newsman, Bill Plant, who covered the marches then and who is with us here today, quipped that the growing number of white people lowered the quality of the singing. To those who marched, though, those old gospel songs must have never sounded so sweet. In time, their chorus would well up and reach President Johnson, and he would send them protection and speak to the nation, echoing their call for America and the world to hear. We shall overcome. What enormous faith these men and women had. Faith in God, but also faith in America. The Americans who crossed this bridge, they were not physically imposing, but they gave courage to millions. They held no elected office, but they led a nation. They marched as Americans who had endured hundreds of years of brutal violence, countless daily indignities, but they didn't seek special treatment, just the equal treatment promised to them almost a century before. What they did here will reverberate through the ages. Not because the change they won was preordained, not because their victory was complete, but because they proved that nonviolent change is possible, that love and hope can conquer hate. As we commemorate their achievement, we are well served to remember that at the time of the marches, many in power condemned rather than praised them. Back then, they were called communists, or half-breeds, or outside agitators, sexual and moral degenerates, and worse. They were called everything but the name their parents gave them. Their faith was questioned. Their lives were threatened. Their patriotism challenged. And yet, what could be more American than what happened in this place? What could more profoundly vindicate the idea of America than plain and humble people, unsung, the downtrodden, the dreamers not of high station, not born to wealth or privilege, not of one religious tradition, but many, coming together to shape their country's course? What greater expression of faith in the American experiment than this? What greater form of patriotism is there than the belief that America is not yet finished? That we are strong enough to be self-critical? That each successive generation can look upon our imperfections and decide that it is in our power to remake this nation to more closely align with our highest ideals? That's why Selma is not some outlier in the American experience. That's why it's not a museum or a static monument to behold from a distance. It is instead the manifestation of a creed written into our founding documents. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. These are not just words. They're a living thing. A call to action, a roadmap for citizenship, and an insistence in the capacity of free men and women to shape our own destiny. For founders like Franklin and Jefferson, for leaders like Lincoln and FDR, the success of our experiment in self-government rested on engaging all of our citizens in this work. And that's what we celebrate here in Selma. That's what this movement was all about. One leg in our long journey toward freedom. The American instinct that led these young men and women to pick up the torch and cross this bridge, that's the same instinct that moved patriots to choose revolution over tyranny. It's the same instinct that drew immigrants from across oceans and the Rio Grande. The same instinct that led women to reach for the ballot. Workers to organize against an unjust status quo. The same instinct that led us to plant a flag at Iwo Jima and on the surface of the moon. It's the idea held by generations of citizens who believe that America is a constant work in progress, who believe that loving this country requires more than singing its praises or avoiding uncomfortable truths. It requires the occasional disruption, the willingness to speak out for what is right, to shake up the status quo. That's America. That's what makes us unique. That's what cements our reputation as a beacon of opportunity. Young people behind the Iron Curtain would see Selma and eventually tear down that wall. Young people in Soweto would hear Bobby Kennedy talk about ripples of hope and eventually banish the scourge of apartheid. Young people in Burma went to prison rather than submit to military rule. They saw what John Lewis had done. From the streets of Tunis to the Maidan in Ukraine, this generation of young people can draw strength from this place, where the powerless could change the world's greatest power and push their leaders to expand the boundaries of freedom. They saw that idea made real right here in Selma, Alabama. They saw that idea manifest itself here in America. Because of campaigns like this, the Voting Rights Act was passed. Political and economic and social barriers came down. And the change these men and women wrought is visible here today in the presence of African Americans who run boardrooms, who sit on the bench, who serve in elected office from small towns to big cities, from the Congressional Black Caucus all the way to the Oval Office. Because of what they did, the doors of opportunity swung open not just for black folks, but for every American. Women marched through those doors. Latinos marched through those doors. Asian Americans, gay Americans, Americans with disabilities, they all came through those doors. Their endeavors gave the entire South the chance to rise again, not by reasserting the past, but by transcending the past. What a glorious thing, Dr. King might say. And what a solemn debt we owe. Which leads us to ask, just how might we repay that debt? First and foremost, we have to recognize that one day's commemoration, no matter how special, is not enough. If Selma taught us anything, it's that our work is never done. The American experiment in self-government gives work and purpose to each generation. Selma teaches us as well that action requires that we shed our cynicism. For when it comes to the pursuit of justice, we can afford neither complacency nor despair. You know, just this week I was asked whether I thought the Department of Justice's Ferguson report shows that, with respect to race, little has changed in this country. And I understood the question. The report's narrative was sadly familiar. It evoked the kind of abuse and disregard for citizens that spawned the civil rights movement. But I rejected the notion that nothing's changed. What happened in Ferguson may not be unique, but it's no longer endemic. It's no longer sanctioned by law or by custom. And before the civil rights movement, it most surely was. We do a disservice to the cause of justice by intimating that bias and discrimination are immutable, that racial division is inherent in America. If you think nothing's changed in the past 50 years, ask somebody who lived through the Selma or Chicago or Los Angeles of the 1950s. Ask the female CEO who once might have been assigned to the secretarial pool if nothing's changed. Ask your gay friend if it's easier to be out and proud in America now than it was 30 years ago. To deny this progress, this hard-won progress, our progress, would be to rob us of our own agency, our own capacity, our responsibility to do what we can to make America better. Of course, a more common mistake is to suggest that Ferguson is an isolated incident, that racism is banished, that the work that drew men and women to Selma is now complete, and that whatever racial tensions remain are a consequence of those seeking to play the race card for their own purposes. We don't need a Ferguson report to know that's not true. We just need to open our eyes and our ears and our hearts to know that this nation's racial history still casts its long shadow upon us. We know the march is not yet over. We know the race is not yet won. We know that reaching that blessed destination where we are judged, all of us, by the content of our character requires admitting as much, facing up to the truth. We are capable of bearing a great burden, James Baldwin once wrote. Once we discover that the burden is reality and arrive where reality is, there's nothing America can't handle if we actually look squarely at the problem. And this is work for all Americans, not just some, not just whites, not just blacks. If we want to honor the courage of those who marched that day, then all of us are called to possess their moral imagination. All of us will need to feel as they did the fierce urgency of now. All of us need to recognize as they did that change depends on our actions, on our attitudes, the things we teach our children. And if we make such an effort, no matter how hard it may sometimes seem, laws can be passed and consciences can be stirred and consensus can be built. With such an effort, we can make sure our criminal justice system serves all and not just some. Together, we can raise the level of mutual trust that policing is built on. The idea that police officers are members of the community they risk their lives to protect. And citizens in Ferguson and New York and Cleveland, they just want the same thing young people here marched for 50 years ago, the protection of the law. Together, we can address unfair sentencing and overcrowded prisons and the stunted circumstances that rob too many boys of the chance to become men and rob the nation of too many men who could be good dads and good workers and good neighbors. With effort, we can roll back poverty and the roadblocks to opportunity. You know, Americans don't accept a free ride for anybody. Nor do we believe in equality of outcomes, but we do expect equal opportunity. And if we really mean it, if we're not just giving lip service to it, but if we really mean it and we're willing to sacrifice for it, then yes, we can make sure every child gets an education suitable to this new century. One that expands imaginations and lifts sights and gives those children the skills they need. We can make sure every person willing to work has the dignity of a job and a fair wage and a real voice and sturdier rungs on that ladder into the middle class. And with effort, we can protect the foundation stone of our democracy for which so many marched across this bridge, and that is the right to vote. Right now, in 2015, 50 years after Selma, there are laws across this country designed to make it harder for people to vote. As we speak, more such laws are being proposed. Meanwhile, the Voting Rights Act, the culmination of so much blood, so much sweat and tears, the product of so much sacrifice in the face of wanton violence, the Voting Rights Act stands weakened. Its future subject to political rancor. How can that be? The Voting Rights Act was one of the crowning achievements of our democracy, the result of Republican and Democratic efforts. President Reagan signed its renewal when he was in office. President George W. Bush signed its renewal when he was in office. 100 members of Congress have come here today to honor people who are willing to die for the right to protect it. If we want to honor this day, let that 100 go back to Washington and gather 400 more and together pledge to make it their mission to restore that law this year. That's how we honor those on this bridge. Of course, our democracy is not the task of Congress alone, or the courts alone, or even the president alone. If every new voter suppression law was struck down today, we would still have here in America one of the lowest voting rates among free peoples. 50 years ago, registering to vote here in Selma and much of the South meant guessing the number of jelly beans in a jar, the number of bubbles on a bar of soap. It meant risking your dignity and sometimes your life. What's our excuse today for not voting? How do we so casually discard the right for which so many fought? How do we so fully give away our power, our voice in shaping America's future? Why are we pointing to somebody else when we could take the time just to go to the polling places? We give away our power. Fellow marchers, so much has changed in 50 years. We have endured war and we fashioned peace. We've seen technological wonders that touch every aspect of our lives. We take for granted conveniences that our parents could have scarcely imagined. But what has not changed is the imperative of citizenship. That willingness of a 26-year-old deacon or a Unitarian minister or a young mother of five to decide they love this country so much that they'd risk everything to realize its promise. That's what it means to love America. That's what it means to believe in America. That's what it means when we say America is exceptional. For we were born of change. We broke the old aristocracies, declaring ourselves entitled not by bloodline, but endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. We secure our rights and responsibilities through a system of self-government, of and by and for the people. That's why we argue and fight with so much passion and conviction, because we know our efforts matter. We know America is what we make of it. Look at our history. We are Lewis and Clark and Sacagawea, pioneers who braved the unfamiliar, followed by a stampede of farmers and miners and entrepreneurs and hucksters. That's our spirit. That's who we are. We're Sojourner Truth and Fannie Lou Hamer, women who could do as much as any man and then some. And we're Susan B. Anthony, who shook the system until the law reflected that truth. That is our character. We're the immigrants who stowed away on ships to reach these shores, the huddled masses yearning to breathe free, Holocaust survivors, Soviet defectors, the lost boys of Sudan. We're the hopeful strivers who cross the Rio Grande because we want our kids to know a better life. That's how we came to be. We're the slaves who built the White House and the economy of the South. We're the ranch hands and cowboys who opened up the West, the countless laborers who laid rail and raised skyscrapers and organized for workers' rights. We're the fresh-faced GIs who fought to liberate a continent. And we're the Tuskegee Airmen and the Navajo code talkers and the Japanese Americans who fought for this country even as their own liberty had been denied. We're the firefighters who rushed into those buildings on 9/11. The volunteers who signed up to fight in Afghanistan and Iraq. We're the gay Americans whose blood ran in the streets of San Francisco and New York just as blood ran down this bridge. We are storytellers, writers, poets, artists who abhor unfairness and despise hypocrisy and give voice to the voiceless and tell truths that need to be told. We're the inventors of gospel and jazz and blues, bluegrass and country and hip-hop and rock and roll and our very own sound with all the sweet sorrow and reckless joy of freedom. We are Jackie Robinson, enduring scorn and spike cleats and pitches coming straight to his head and stealing home in the World Series anyway. We are the people Langston Hughes wrote of who build our temples for tomorrow, strong as we know how. We are the people Emerson wrote of, who for truth and honor's sake stand fast and suffer long, who are never tired so long as we can see far enough. That's what America is. Not stock photos or airbrushed history or feeble attempts to define some of us as more American than others. We respect the past, but we don't pine for the past. We don't fear the future. We grab for it. America's not some fragile thing. We are large, in the words of Whitman, containing multitudes. We are boisterous and diverse and full of energy, perpetually young in spirit. That's why someone like John Lewis at the ripe old age of 25 could lead a Mardi March. And that's what the young people here today and listening all across the country must take away from this day. You are America, unconstrained by habit and convention, unencumbered by what is, because you're ready to seize what ought to be. For everywhere in this country, there are first steps to be taken. There's new ground to cover. There are more bridges to be crossed. And it is you, the young and fearless at heart, the most diverse and educated generation in our history, who the nation is waiting to follow. Because Selma shows us that America's not the project of any one person. Because the single most powerful word in our democracy is the word we. We the people. We shall overcome. Yes, we can. That word is owned by no one. It belongs to everyone. Oh, what a glorious task we are given to continually try to improve this great nation of ours. 50 years from Bloody Sunday, our march is not yet finished, but we're getting closer. 239 years after this nation's founding, our union is not yet perfect, but we are getting closer. Our job's easier because somebody already got us through that first mile. Somebody already got us over that bridge. When it feels the road's too hard, when the torch we've been past feels too heavy, we will remember these early travelers and draw strength from their example and hold firmly to the words of the prophet Isaiah. Those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on the wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. We honor those who walked so we could run. We must run so our children soar, and we will not grow weary, for we believe in the power of an awesome God, and we believe in this country's sacred promise. May he bless those warriors of justice no longer with us, and bless the United States of America. Thank you, everybody.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.